I think, you know, there's an attraction into something like law. Very often, you know, unconsciously, people are drawn to the law because it offers, at least the notion is that it'll offer certainty. Isn't that right? You know, there's a law that will determine the rights and wrongs of a situation, the ethics, the lack of ethics, the certainty of fact, and so on. Of course, it's far more nuanced when people actually come into the law. One of the very first disappointments that has to be endured is that it doesn't offer it that much certainty at all. It asks very often more questions than it answers. So my experience of working with lawyers from the very first day of their training here in Ireland is working with young people and then more senior people at the other end, perhaps of that journey, to navigate complexity, to navigate uncertainty, actually, and to be able to hold their own, you know, to hold the work of their clients and their field of expertise, but also be able to relate to people. And it's a very complex business. And it's made all the more complex right now because its role in society, I think, is changing dramatically.
Welcome to our most recent podcast series, Collective Intelligence. At a moment when the shape of work is being redrawn, we seek to explore the magic that happens when groups perform at more than the sum of their parts. A theme we researched extensively in our book, The Social Brain, The Psychology of Successful Groups.
Welcome to this episode of Collective Intelligence Podcasts. I'm thrilled to be with Antoinette Moriarty, who is the Director of Solicitor Services at the Law Society of Ireland. I've invited her onto the podcast because it's such an interesting moment for the legal community. There's so much going on that solicitors have to really be conscious of as they move into a kind of new era, really, of the legal profession. If it's not AI and automation that seems to be biting at the heels of how the work is done, lawyers also have to think about the consolidation of small legal practices. There is a kind of shifting regulatory framework. Lawyers have to be incredibly conscious of things around ethical and professional practices. And of course, all of this against a backdrop of a rapidly changing context in which the legal fraternity is stepping into kind of uncertain waters. So that gives us a bit of a context of why it's so important to really be leaning into these conversations. So welcome, Antoinette. I'm really excited to explore the opportunities and also challenges that you have leading such an important part of the legal community. You started off as doing interpretation and translation. You also have spent much of your career actually in psychotherapy, particularly working around groups. And as you know, we've written extensively on thinking about how groups thrive. So this really chimes actually with some hugely interesting themes that are emerging at this moment in time. Antoinette, you've also just moved out of being head of psychological services at the Law Society of Ireland, and you've moved into a new role, which is director of solicitor services. So we're at a real moment, I think, in thinking about careers and professions.
Thank you. It's so lovely to get an opportunity to speak together, Sam. Thank you. And similarly, I think, you know, the work that you do and the way you think about how you collect people and how you collect ideas, and as you call it, collective intelligence, that's a fascination to me. So no matter what I was studying or working within, I think that idea of how does the person engage with the system, the environment, the collective has been there from the beginning. So it's great. Let's unpack it a little bit.
Brilliant. And I have to, full disclosure, Antoinette, you kind of have had the career I sort of slightly wished I'd had, because I think I've been completely fascinated with all aspects of psychotherapy and group analysis and how we can bring this into the workplace even more.
It's not too late.
Maybe a bit. But let's begin just thinking about what some of the big societal patterns and trends are at the moment. That professions like the legal profession, which people entered into seemingly because it can feel quite traditional and quite structured, but it's, of course, undergoing huge change at the moment. I mean, we've got massive external factors, AI, the consolidation of the legal practices, and some of the shifting dynamics about how the law itself is viewed.
That's right.
I just wonder how you are seeing the stresses and strains play out in your own work with the lawyers in Ireland.
Yeah, I think that's really well observed, actually. I think, you know, there's an attraction into something like law. Very often, you know, unconsciously, people are drawn to the law because it offers, at least the notion is that it'll offer certainty. Isn't that right? You know, there's a law that will determine the rights and wrongs of a situation, the ethics, the lack of ethics, the certainty of fact, and so on. Of course, it's far more nuanced when people actually come into the law. One of the very first disappointments that has to be endured is that it doesn't offer it that much certainty at all. It asks very often more questions than it answers. So my experience of working with lawyers from the very first day of their training here in Ireland is working with young people and then more senior people at the other end, perhaps of that journey, to navigate complexity, to navigate uncertainty, actually, and to be able to hold their own, you know, to hold the work of their clients and their field of expertise, but also be able to relate to people. And it's a very complex business. And it's made all the more complex right now because its role in society, I think, is changing dramatically. And as you've said, those huge external forces. And I guess the other feature, one is the attraction in because the idea or the illusion is it'll offer me certainty. And the other is that piece around position. You know, there's a lot of significance needs are met through the professions, whether it's medicine or law or any of the big professions, accountancy, you know, that idea of being significant. And of course, that's now under threat. Because access to knowledge and expertise is so ubiquitous, it's so easy, it's so free, so cheap. The idea of having a very specialist service that's expensive and that relies upon information, that's under siege.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I mean, the shifting sands really of how, I suppose, communities look to the law and to lawyers in particular, mm-hmm. and what mm-hmm. we're seeing certainly across the pond, you know, how to take these stands when you are in the legal profession and what it means from a personal perspective, both in terms of your own understanding, as well as how to honor your profession. I mean, that must cause quite a lot, as you describe, kind of dissonance. I mean, how are you seeing that play out with the lawyers that you work with?
Yeah, well, I think what we have certainly heard right around the country, Sam, at our gatherings, but also when you work individually with lawyers, is that there is an incredible tension around the personal and the professional, and that, you know, people are being asked really to do the impossible, to do the absurd, as we spoke about, you and I, when we were planning our wonderful festival, which we held this autumn, the theme of which was, this is absurd. And that theme came from listening very deeply to lots of lawyers in practice who were telling us that it is asking the impossible to ask somebody to navigate this particular moment in time with the geopolitical change, the economic changing sands, the changing in access to data and information and expertise, the kind of post-pandemic generation of lawyers who are coming in who wouldn't have had the same level, perhaps, of exposure to complexity in their younger forming years and are now being asked to be involved in very difficult transactional work. It's quite impossible, actually, to do it without good scaffolding and good structures. And the hopeful piece is, with good scaffolding and good healthy cultural structures, it is absolutely doable and in fact really satisfying work.
Yeah, I mean, I like your use of the word scaffolding, and I think that's what you do brilliantly at the Law Society of Ireland, is really imagining a kind of future in which lawyers can absolutely thrive. And I'm just curious, Antoinette, I mean, everyone is talking about AI at the moment. It is the topic of the day. One can't escape.
Yes.
And I just wonder, are you seeing any kind of real impact from an AI point of view? I mean, I know there's been quite a lot of conversation about how the professions are going to be particularly affected. Is this something that's on the horizon for you or already you're dealing with?
Yeah, for sure. And you know, I think it's in the consciousness of the profession as much as in the practice, really.
Yeah.
And one of the ways it's showing up at the moment, which is not unusual, I think when we're met with big threats, you know, in our lives as people, what we tend to do with them is put them under the bed, isn't it? It's like the monster under the bed. And there is quite a bit of that, I would say, happening. And that's not just particular to Ireland. I'm sure it's the same in the UK. And what I mean by that is that there is a kind of a dancing around AI as a tool and a threat, and a bit of uncertainty about whether it's going to result in, you know, law firms having to reduce their billing, reduce their headcount, perhaps not have the same value to their clients as they might have had. And at the same time, there is opportunity there, you know, because, for example, if you speak to people in smaller firms, for the first time perhaps ever, they are now potentially in a position to compete with larger firms, with medium-sized firms on specific areas of work, because they will be able to become so efficient so quickly and so adaptably that if they really want to, put themselves in line for bigger pieces of work, more complex pieces of work, they don't need to hire in 10 new people to be able to do that. So it's really interesting. It depends on who you're speaking with. But I guess from our perspective and our service at the psychological level, it's that piece around changing identity. It's kind of blowing a big hole, really, even if it is temporary, because that's how change works, isn't it? It's blowing a big hole in our idea of what the law is, at a time also where the other big influence is around, you know, the anti-fact, anti-kind of truth movement. And can you imagine a time when lawyers, you know, could be more helpful and more valuable to us than right now? So I think it's a push and pull, and I think it's really important for organizations like the Law Society of Ireland, but global organizations and society itself, to really decide what is it that we add here, you know, to really be clear on our purpose. And the profession's purpose is, it's really critically important around the notion of holding society actually to a high standard of ethical practice, to maintain accountability in all transactions, whether they're commercial or family or personal or private, equity or IP or IT. I mean, I can't think of an area where accountability, ethical standards, being able to ask difficult questions, being able to hold a position of ambiguity where something isn't clear, and not rush to polarizing and predetermining and closing down debate or discussion. So those are the pieces that lawyers bring to any engagement. And I think they're incredibly important.
I think that's such a wonderful kind of tribute, actually, to the skills and capabilities that we see in the legal profession. And I think particularly around really interrogating ideas and getting to the heart and fact of the matter. And as you say, the sort of anti-fact movement and this ability to really disrupt what we've come to think about as being kind of structured and in place, I think must be a very, very interesting moment. And certainly if one can outsource the kind of more technical side of things to AI and allow the broader kind of thinking space and hand that over to the lawyers, I think that that's a very exciting future, really, isn't it?
And I guess that's where you know, people like you in your space, that I think is the opportunity for lawyers, is to be able to reach out and say, you know what, we don't know an awful lot about how to reframe our thinking, how to reposition our skills, how to engage, you know, with this changing time. And maybe around the leadership space in particular is what I'm thinking, to be able to avail of support and scaffolding.
Antoinette, you've spent a lifetime in the kind of group analytics space, which is, of course, where a lot of unspoken dynamics and patterns take place that people are not necessarily even recognizing. Mm-hmm. I mean, from your perspective, what are some of the things that you're noticing that need to be paid more attention at this moment?
Yeah, well, I think the one that's kind of on my mind a lot of the time when I work, whether it's with individuals or groups, or with an organization, it's the same kind of piece that keeps emerging actually. And it is this kind of slide away from the group, the collective, to the individual. And it's being, you know, that's what's being valued. So, you know, I think we all spend more time than we'd like to on Instagram, but even just taking that platform, it is individuals, isn't it? For the most part, speaking to camera. So they're either sitting in their car, drinking coffees, or applying their makeup to camera, or, you know, cooking in their kitchens and walking us through it, or whatever it might be. It's such an interesting kind of move away from the group, the family around the table, the group of colleagues in an office. And something got really interrupted, Sam, didn't it, during COVID,
Yeah.
And I would say, you know, when you look at that kind of with this like a therapeutic lens or a group analytic lens, that interruption is a rupture really in our kind of the membrane of society. And it doesn't just, you know, knit up the same way. That rupture knits up kind of defensively, if you wish. Yeah. And that means that we have to do something to kind of make up for the gap. So what do? We begin to look inwards. We begin to think of the self and I as the more important. But of course, our you know, as humans, I often think about this, like we're basically quite primitive in many ways. And our biology is very primitive. Our neurobiology is quite primitive. So that means that we actually come out hardwired. We know this now. We're hardwired for connection. We can't regulate our own anxiety or stress or upsets, even minor upsets, fully on our own. You know, our brains are designed to co-regulate so that if I sit with you as opposed to speak with you, you know, over where you are in London and where I am in Dublin, you know, we're using this kind of fantastic virtual platform. But if we sit beside each other as we've done, it's a completely different experience. It's a much richer experience. And it actually soothes something in us. It also ignites something in us around our curiosity, our interest levels, our energy levels, our concentration levels. Body doubling has become a thing now with children, believe it or not. In school shared spaces, if children are struggling with concentration, another adult is asked to sit in with that child to body double to enhance their concentration span. So, you know, we may wish for it to be a very eye-oriented society, and that's a temporary kind of compensatory stage, I think. It's also, of course, you know, very satisfying and gratifying in the short term to have people think and speak about themselves as if we can do that just on our own. But of course, in real terms, anxiety levels have never been higher. Mood disorder levels have never been higher. Addiction levels are very high. And those are all symptoms, really, of the individual trying to do too much, actually, on our own.
Well, that is wonderfully put. And as you know, we have written so much on this kind of need for connection and how social connection is, as you say, we are hardwired to connect. But of course, a profession, like just to come back to the legal profession, I mean, one often thinks of it as a sort of highly individualistic profession, really. And I don't know if that's true or an external view, but I imagine in the work that you're having to do and having to think about is how do you create this sort of network of connection that is really supportive. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of professions that would fall in this particular category. I mean, I'm thinking of even the sort of very, the professions where it's years of study, it's absolutely focusing on a kind of technical expertise. But at the same time, it's wired in a sense for individual focus. I mean, through even something as simple as billable hours has at its very heart the idea of kind of I'm an individual in it for myself, not to be too reductionist. But I think, I think Antoinette, some of the brilliant work that you're doing and what really struck me is that creating this scaffolding around building connection and building a sense of community is a way of mitigating what some of the deep concerns that are arising.
That's right. And that's the intention actually. So it is really intentional to bring people together. And I think you're so right, Sam, about the individualistic piece and the zero-sum game people talk about in law, whereby if I bring you in on a matter, I lose out because then you also have to charge fees and my billing might be down because I've brought you in. So what does that do to our, you know, our natural instinct to collaborate, to reach out, to get different perspectives, to be able to, you know, run to each other and say, help, you know, I'm lost, I'm stuck, this is really messy, it's really tricky, I don't know where I'm going with it. And that's not to say that lawyers don't help each other in that informal way. Of course they do. And in fact, as a community, my experience is, having worked with lawyers for over 20 years, I don't know many communities that have each other's back actually behind the scenes as well as solicitors do for each other, or counsel. Our barrister system and solicitor system is quite different in Ireland, but they of course work together. But I think what does happen is in the real context of the work and how the work is organized and how it's given out to people, how it's shared with people, how it's remunerated, that is still really rooted in the individual. And of course, the opportunity now, Sam, with AI, is that that gets completely reimagined, you know?
Very exciting. Antoinetta, I also know that you've recently moved into your new role, which is fantastic. And I'm wondering your background in psychotherapy. I mean, thinking about how you're stepping into this incredibly strategic leadership role. I mean, what are you going to be drawing on from your own experience? I'm really curious.
Yeah, I guess for starters, on colleagues. So that's the first thing. Even when I hear you describe it like that, it gives me a sense of fear. So I don't see it as, you know, I'm trying not to see it anyway, as something too big or too daunting. I think it's a manageable, hopefully, a manageable step in the right direction in terms of being able to bring, as you say, that lens, which is really about people and how we work and how we work optimally, to bring that into all solicitor services. So, you know, there are going to be three main areas of focus: the psychological piece, which we're very familiar with in my team already, but then I'm gaining and have gained very delightedly two new teams. One, which is going to work on engagement. And that is something I know you in your business are very committed to. And I actually just this morning, so something that I shared with our team. So learning from colleagues is my starting point. But that piece around really engaging with people in a way that has meaning and purpose and value, and that people leave it feeling enriched and enhanced. There's going to be a whole team working on how the Law Society engages with solicitors and being able to bring that depth of understanding about what good engagement looks like, what good engagement yields, what are the outputs of good engagement relative to, you know, fairly traditional engagement. And of course, they're vastly different, aren't they, when it's done intentionally. Yeah. And then the third area is career and practice development, which I'm very excited about, I have to say. And it's about business and about running your practice and about setting up businesses and about how you can develop your leadership skills, how you can work with your teams, how you can energize your organization by having a really useful strategy. I mean, it's all that kind of good stuff that lawyers haven't perhaps had as much exposure to as you might imagine.
Well, I mean, feel very hopeful for the future when thinking about young people entering into the different professions. And I know that we've spoken a little bit about how, you know, our young people were affected, as you mentioned before, by COVID, by the pandemic, by really entering into workplaces that were very different to the workplaces that we entered into when we were young, because simply the social cohesion is not there, certainly a lot of working from home and so on. But I'm also, one reads on the daily how, you know, the graduate jobs are decreasing, that there's no space for young people to join organizations for all the reasons that we've mentioned. I'm just really interested in, what are you seeing with our young people? I mean, what are some of the trends that you're observing, and where's the hope? And is there hope?
I'm full of hope, full of hope.
First, great.
First, which is why I've always stayed close to the trainee end of our society. Actually, to be honest with you, it's so enriching to be around young people, and they are just incredible, Sam. And I'm sure it's the same in the UK and in other jurisdictions. They really are evolved, you know, in a way that we've had to do all this stuff backwards. You know, anything I've ever learned, it's because I've kind of needed to figure something out and I've had to go looking for it, or I've had to, you know. I think these young people have had very different experiences of growing up in Ireland, for example. If I take this group that have come into us. So they have come into an Ireland where it is possible to, you know, live a very good, healthy, long life with a just and fair and relatively equal society, with a stable government, with a government, you know, successive governments that have looked after people on the margins, perhaps not optimally. We have a homeless crisis that is persistent and is very difficult to shift. And I think there's a lot that could be said about that in terms of our history as a people and how displaced Irish people have been, and the reliance always on travel as a means of kind of solving problems, you know, sending people out of the country. So that is definitely a shadow. But we have we were the first European country to legislate for marriage referendum for the LGBTQI community, for example. And we have had lots of other liberal types of structures in place as these young people have grown up. And they have grown up with, you know, a far greater degree of equality among young men and young women than we would have had even 40 years ago, really. And that is coming through. And so we have the largest group of trainees that we've had since the recession in our training school this year, in our law school, come in September. And they, you know, they are the youngest as well, which I think is really hopeful, because it's just, there's something about that energy. And they are majority female. And that is going to be so good for the profession, Sam. You know, young, bright people, lots of female energy in there in terms of how women approach work, how they approach family, how they approach society. I'm very excited about how, if the structures can accommodate them appropriately, how they can make a difference.
Well, Antoinette, I mean, I'm conscious that both you and I grew up in very different places, but around about the same era. I mean, we were both at university in the 80s and sort of early 90s. And both, I don't think either Ireland or South Africa would have been places in which one could imagine a particularly hopeful future at that time.
No.
Certainly in apartheid South Africa, and as you say, you know, lots of kind of restrictions in Ireland. So I think I love the fact that you've reframed this as understanding the context now, which is, as you say, markedly different from our own experience. So where some of the losses around what the workplace looks like in a post-pandemic world is offset by also all the opportunities that young people have in terms of freedom and expression. And I think that, as you say, that is a very, very hopeful thing indeed. And they are incredibly impressive. We always leave at the end of our podcast with a kind of message of hope that we actually are the custodians for our next generation. And it does sound that is something that you're thinking about very deliberately in your own work. As we all should do, having benefited from experience.
That's right.
Antoinette, I'm curious that you ran a festival, which I was very lightly involved in, but was what a joyous piece of work. And I think what struck me particularly and what I found so exciting about it is that you designed a piece which included actors, authors, comedians, music, art, philosophy. You had a wonderful title, This Is Absurd. And where did that come from? And maybe just to give, if you don't mind, giving a tiny bit of context to the festival as well, because I think it was almost a kind of disruption to how one would imagine a really boring gathering of professionals.
Yeah, I know. There is the weight of the stereotype is there, isn't it? Well, I mean, firstly, you weren't lightly involved. You were really central to our thinking, and you hopped over on a plane and sat with our team in the early stages of thinking about this. So even that, I think, was just, you know, that step to look up and look out and see who you know, who's in your circle and who has energy that you know is going to bring something. And I think you absolutely brought that, Sam, on that day with our team. And, you know, I think that is part of what we try and share with that annual festival, is a different way of engaging with ideas and with problems so that they don't become defining of us and they don't, you know, keep us locked into the problem. I think we often fall in love with the problem in the legal profession. So we're really good at saying, oh, the model doesn't work and the billable hour and the competitiveness and the long hours and the burnout and the addiction and the bullying. And, you know, it's report after report after report. And I guess a couple of years ago, we decided, why can't we just at least have, as a starting point, one big event in the year where it's more joyful and we celebrate, you know, and that's the starting point. And each year has a different theme. And this year, I think the only theme possible was the absurdity of life with all that's happening geopolitically. You know, there's such suffering in different parts of the world and there is such polarizing happening. And, you know, there's something quite extreme happening in terms of if I'm right, then you must be wrong. And of course, you know, coming from the history that you've come from, that never works out well for anybody, that we need to make room for each other's difference rather than, you know, rail against it. And so we started to think about what are the places where we can get some guidance, some consolation, some enlightenment in this time. And we went to literature. And the existentialists, who of course were all about complexity and the terror of being alive, really, because we're always in the shadow of death, aren't we? As we live, you know, we're in the shadow of meaninglessness. And no matter how advanced people are in their professional lives or how successful they become, we all carry that piece within us. And I think this moment in time, because of the extremes, it's become a little bit more possible to articulate the individual experience of that, which everybody will share. Anybody listening to this will know what we're talking about, is that we can often feel completely insignificant, irrelevant, uncertain, afraid, overwhelmed, you know, and not maybe able to say, come and talk to me, come and help me. Can you join us in this kind of dilemma and give us some new ideas? In fact, very often professionals will do the opposite. They'll isolate. They will in some way try and minimize the reality of their lives all day long, for long, long hours, for long, long weeks, for long, long months, for long, long years, until, of course, it becomes impossible. And the festival was a kind of lighthearted way of maybe just speaking about that it is absurd to expect that of ourselves. And, you know, whose idea is that anyway? And so we had writers, we had the myth of Sisyphus pushing that boulder up the hill, you know, day in, day out, starting at the bottom, up again, starting at the bottom, up again. And of course, the learning, when we revisited Sisyphus, and I'd forgotten this, but the learning apparently from that story is that, you know, the hopeful piece is that we begin to make meaning of that relentlessness, you know, so rather than trying to see it as without meaning and without purpose and just a depletion, we begin to reframe the complexity of life as some place that we get the opportunity to make meaning of what can be absurd. And that's complex, I know, but I think it's actually an incredibly freeing place to arrive at. Acceptance is, I really think of it as a very powerful position rather than a giving in. I think it's a really powerful place to arrive at.
I mean, one of the things that I absolutely, first of all, loved about the idea of the festival is this kind of disruption of assumption about what a gathering of people could be. And I've always drawn in the work of Priya Parker around the art of gathering. And of course, sort of bringing in something from the side, which is literature, and using sort of meaning that is in some senses thousands of years old to help us frame what is going on in our current lives, I think is very powerful. But Antoinette, something else that you did and we've done during the course of this conversation is introduce language, which sometimes feels antithetical to business language, you know, words like kindness or sort of forgiveness or compassion for self or absurdity. And there is something of the cutting out of interesting language in organizations that is so disheartening because language has this absolute place for all of us. And I'm just so curious about how you think about language in relation to dealing with some of these big issues. I know you've spoken about, using the authors that you spoke about. But, I mean, have you had any other thinking about how to really leverage the power of language?
Yeah, I have actually. And mainly because, you know, and again, it's like we're always trying to figure something out for ourselves, aren't we? What draws us to, what draws me to language, I guess. My own history with language is that I grew up in a part of the country where Irish is still spoken daily. I was educated through the medium of Irish and it has, you know, always remained with me, I suppose, that willingness or curiosity about being able to think about something from different perspectives, because that's, I think, what language gives us, actually. It gives us a kind of a roadmap for life. And when we take away any language, actually, of course, we take away an incredible source of understanding. And that has been, you know, a tragic loss in the case of Ireland, even though the rate of use of the language is up by 6%. So I'm gonna get that.
I read that. That's exciting.
Yeah, it's fantastic. But it's also, you know, it's always complex because it's connected with politics and it's connected with identity. But I'm really glad I had that, I suppose. And I'm really glad I was able to pass that along to my children, two of whom went to three of them started in an Irish language school and one just couldn't get there and moved to a German school, actually, here in Dublin. And so they've all had, you know, lots of different kind of voices and different languages in their mouths, as I used to say to them when they were little. And I think that's really good because I think it actually makes us be able to meet people in a way. So this is the link with the kindness and the language and the use of it. I think we can meet people differently if we've had a couple of different perspectives put into us from a very early age. And if we haven't, we can acquire them. And I think the language of business is its own language. And I think it can become soulless. So the personal piece in this was a couple of weeks ago, I remember hitting a bit of a wall with our team and saying, I actually cannot even read, or if I read something, I can't retain it, or it's not landing with me. And it was material that just felt so devoid of color and devoid of context and devoid of the personal and the human that I actually found I could read something 10 times, Sam, and it wasn't actually landing with me. And I was describing it to the team as synthetic. And I think that is one of the challenges of the AI kind of space we're in right now. A lot of the language is, it's not capturing the human experience. And we need to bring it in even more strongly if we are to work with AI and not against it, or not in spite of it, or not, you know, embracing it too unboundedly. Then we need to bring in our own real language of kindness, humanity, all of those strong words that have resonance actually with people and with the human experience and the human condition.
Antoinette, I mean, we probably only have time for one question, but it's connected and hopefully brings together all these threads, because something that has frustrated me almost in every single podcast that I've done when I've spoken about language particularly is this kind of reflection that businesses seem almost incapable, or people leading businesses seem almost incapable of expanding their understanding of what meaning is. And it gets reduced to a kind of balance sheet. I mean, not in every case, but in many, many cases. And I often sort of in discussion in various conversations is, you know, what is going on there? Why does this happen? And we have interviewed some of the most amazing, this is a recurring question around from some of our brilliant thinkers in the leadership space, is why are organizations simply unable to accept, embrace, move into a different modality that is very, very human at heart. And you're a psychotherapist. You're obviously thinking about this a lot. You're doing it in your own work. I mean, what is the barrier? What do we need to do differently in order for this to take hold?
Oh, wow. I mean, it's a big question.
I know. You bring it home, Antoinette.
I do love the big questions, though. I mean, I think it is a really understandable defense against anxiety at the moment, all of this stuff, you know, strategies, KPIs, OKRs, budget sheets, balance sheets, Excel sheets, a kind of a language that's quite, you know, almost utilitarian. It reminds me of Hard Times and Dickens, you know, that idea. I mean, we're so close to that idea of almost going back to the idea of hands, if you remember that from Dickens's Hard Times, which I read when I was in boarding school a million years ago. And here we are living it in a way. I think if we can get the scaffolding right, Sam, I really am hopeful that when we can get the culture of a profession right, get supportive structures in place, get people who, like yourselves and like the work our team, our psychological services team is doing, like the work our new department will be doing, like the work lots of coaching colleagues are doing, lots of organizational development specialists are doing, get those people in and help professionals to identify what they're really afraid of and what they're really fighting with and what they really want. What's their purpose? You know, what do you want to do with your one wild and precious life, as Mary Oliver says? Like, it's not going to come back again. You know, your 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, whatever it is, they're now spent in organizational life. We've five generations working side by side. You're never going to get that time back again. So can it be used in a way that honors, you know, your potential? I think there's incredible untapped potential in professional services, by the way. And I think people become a little bit one-dimensional in their search to be, you know, recognized, to be promoted, to be relevant, to be accepted by clients, by the structure within which they're working. And something gets lost of what made them brilliant in the first instance. And it gets washed out and diluted and put away. And that comes at a huge price. So I would say bring back in the real, bring back in the mess, bring back in the color, and the organizational performance will enhance. It will go up. It doesn't go down. You know this very well from the work you do with leaders globally. The more real people are, the faster we move forward, actually, not the slower.
What a wonderful way to end. I mean, it's you're absolutely right. Bring the messiness back in. And we know that if it's excluded, it finds another way of popping up. So if there's one message, I guess, to leaders who are listening to this podcast, is probably be a little braver, be a little more courageous, allow the human in. I think, as you say, it is something that we need to be actively encouraging and showcasing. So it's been absolutely wonderful speaking to you, Antoinette, and the work that you're doing is so inspiring for a whole generation of new young solicitors coming into a practice and the adjacent services that I know that you provide. Is there any last kind of wish for leaders who are listening to this?
I mean, I think look up and look out, you know, don't look down into your organizations. I think the solution, you know, that you're seeking is actually probably somewhere else. It's on your run. It's on your walk in the morning. It's when your kids come in from school and you hear a story that they mightn't have told you if you were 4 or 5 hours later coming home in the evening. It's the magic happens actually in the in-between spaces. And I think we need to give our leaders space to think, and it needs to be not just encouraged. I think it needs to be the thing that is privileged. So thinkers and leaders are the same people usually, and let's give them space to think.
That's so wonderful. Thank you very much. For people who are interested in more around some of these topics, do go to the website, which is lawsociety.ie. They produce a fantastic Justice Matters newsletter. You can read some of the work that Antoinette and her team do. And it certainly has a range of tools and insights for those who are in the legal profession. including lots of education pieces as well. So please do head over to that.